Megan McDonough said, "We're seeing cancer-causing chemicals in children's bodies." Dave Brown, a toxicology expert with the Environmental Health Project, who advised the authors of the report, said the study is the first of its kind in Pennsylvania. Dave Brown said policymakers should be alarmed that fracking has been an issue in the state for years. But researchers are just now beginning to test for fracking chemicals in children. While the study doesn't prove that children are contaminated by fracking, the fact that the children both show an elevated body burden of chemicals associated with fracking and live near fracking infrastructure is telling. What would be the explanation of all this, other than these people have potential exposures to these gas fracking chemicals? Dave Brown said in an interview. Indeed, policymakers are alarmed by the study. While some of them are, at least, the fossil fuel industry is known for spending large sums of money to influence lawmakers in Pennsylvania. Last week, a bipartisan group of 35 state lawmakers sent a letter to Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf, a Democrat, requesting he take immediate action and use state funding to conduct a study on exposure to fracking chemicals using similar biomonitoring methods. In short, the lawmakers want Pennsylvania to start testing its own citizens and residents for fracking chemicals years after the state was transformed by a fracking boom. Quite frankly, allowing children and families from throughout our Commonwealth to suffer in the name of corporate profit is unacceptable, unethical, and immoral, said State Senator Katie Muth, a Democrat. Tom Wolf's administration has already given $2.5 million to the University of Pittsburgh to replicate studies from other states on the health effects of fracking and investigate a rash of rare bone cancers among children in southwestern Pennsylvania. A biomonitoring study would go even further, allowing residents to find out whether harmful chemicals associated with fracking are accumulating in their bodies. In southwestern Pennsylvania, there are families grieving the loss of their children due to a rare bone cancer, and they are demanding to know if their suffering is linked to the fracking industry, McDonoghue said. What more do we need to know? How much more suffering must we inflict on these communities before we say, enough is enough?
We get people.
Kids at the U.S. border.
A record number of children are arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border without their parents. Unaccompanied immigrant children are streaming into the United States by crossing the border, raising concerns about human rights as well as security, both inside the country and abroad. Daily apprehension of children is spinning out of control. Many are kept in camps that were not made for children, in conditions not clear for everyone.
What should happen to those children who are making this trip?
Stop them before they get here. Because how many children won't make the trip? Why don't we stop that before it starts?
Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Mila Javamadi. The Biden administration is trying to deter immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers, mostly escaping violence in South and Central America, from entering the U.S. However, he is allowing some unaccompanied minors to enter. The record influx of people has created a rare opportunity for human smuggling gangs. Unfortunately, this is a dark and sad story, but please stay with us as we shed light on this very important issue.
If the parents are in Central America living in poverty, how can they get to Mexico? That's why so many children are fleeing in the first place, because they see the poverty that their parents live in.
The crisis at the border is a telltale of human rights situation in the United States. Putting kids in cages or the so-called migrant facilities shows the depth of U.S. politicians' disregard for children who actually never chose to enter the country on their own.
The Biden administration, along with the Mexican government, needs to disrupt the cartels that are frankly the only ones benefiting from the situation as it currently stands. And then here in the U.S., the Biden administration needs to stand up the infrastructure in terms of facilities, the processes, and then ultimately the capacity so that these children can go through a process that's safe, legal, and humane.
Politicizing the issue and taking advantage of the influx is now on the agenda of many seeking to consolidate their grip on power. Biden's nemesis, namely congressional Republicans, argue that he is ignoring the crisis, pretending that a Republican president like Trump would have performed better.
In reality, Biden has ended the Trump-era practice of expelling immigrant children, but maintained expulsions of immigrant families and single adults. Our first guest today is Todd Miller. Mr. Miller, the United States promotes itself as a protector of human rights across the world. Yet today, unaccompanied children are the most vulnerable victims of the influx at the border. How do you assess the administration's performance in regard to human rights amid the situation at the southern border?
Yeah, I would say that the border itself is designed to be a human rights violation. So it doesn't matter who arrives to the U.S. southern border, in this case, unaccompanied minors. The very way of the kind of enforcement apparatus that's been developed over many, many, many years, by its very design, it forces people into really vulnerable places. It stops people from being able to cross borders. It incarcerates people. And in its very essence, it's a human rights violation. And so, it contradicts this idea of like what is going on the border now, or what's been going on the border, you know, a year ago, or what's been going on the U.S. southern border for decades, actually. It's a constant human rights abuse to the people trying to cross the border. And so that kind of contradicts this idea of the United States being this kind of global messenger of human rights.
Todd Miller, journalist and author of Border Patrol Nation, many thanks for your input.
The new spike in the number of crossings amounts to tragedy for many families and children. For the Biden administration, it has different implications, including partial bending of the law. The Customs and Border Protection would normally receive unaccompanied children first, until the Department of Health and Human Services can provide enough space to accept them in one of their shelters.
Why is it more humane to take these kids, to put them in Border Patrol facilities that were not meant for children, oftentimes for many more days than the legal limit?
Chris, that is not what the prior administration did. You'll forgive me. The prior administration did expel children, did fly children to countries from which they were fleeing, countries that did not have the capacity to administer asylum claims, countries that suffer tremendous violence, poverty, corruption, and other infirmities. So to suggest that the prior administration handled the needs of children in a humane way is just false.
The maximum amount of time a child is legally supposed to be held in Border Patrol custody is 72 hours, but thousands of unaccompanied children had been held in custody for longer, with 2,226 being held for more than 5 days and 823 being held for more than 10 days, according to some reports. We're now joined by Mr. Lima Roca. Mr. Roca, how did we get here?
I do think that the structure of anti-immigration policies, it started in Obama administration when President Barack Hussein he exposed more or less to 500 to 600,000 people every year. So Trump radicalized his speech, radicalized his policies, and Biden, or he cannot dismantle this, or he will preserve this to, I would say hello to Texan Republicans because he needs their support.
Thank you, Bruno Lima Roca, Professor of International Studies. Stay tuned for more.
Early summer is usually the peak of the migrants' arrival. With the steep rise in the number of detentions, more asylum seekers are expected to arrive. Relaxation of enforcement at the border is denied by authorities. However, it plays a major role in the rise.
There are a lot of kids who come without their parents, and many arrive without anything at all because they've been robbed along the way. I even had to share a room with one who was from Guatemala. They put him with us so he wouldn't cry so much, because so many of them cry when their parents don't come for them. It's terrible to see.
It's fair.
Two major hurricanes last year, as well as the coronavirus pandemic, have made it impossible for many to stay in their home countries of Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and Mexico. On the other hand, the situation is adding more stress to the U.S. system and overwhelming the country's resources, which had already been strained due to the COVID-19 pandemic. What role do hurricanes and the pandemic play, and what should the Biden administration do?
What the Biden administration needs to do is probably look at a number of things. The kind of enforcement that makes children vulnerable at our border needs to be addressed. The reasons why people are coming in the first place. For example, right now, a number of people that are coming from Honduras particularly are saying that the hurricanes, and if you remember, there was two catastrophic Category 4 hurricanes that hit the Honduran and Nicaraguan coasts in 2020. Those hurricanes caused huge devastation and displacement, and a lot of people are saying that's one of the reasons why. So you have a climate situation, right? And some of the people that are coming up at this point, and then you look at how the United, you know, if that's the case, then how do you deal with climate change? That would be the sort of questions you would have to why so many people are coming, why so many children are coming. But what seems to be the course of action in the United States, and it doesn't even matter what party it is to continue to do the border enforcement. So by no means with the Biden administration is the border open, right? There's this kind of narrative playing out in the media at this point saying, oh, there's an open border. There is not.
The evolving situation on the U.S.-Mexico border comes with reports of kids who have not seen sunlight in days, and others often going days without taking showers. Some of the kids sleep in bunk beds, some of them three bunks high. Still better than overcrowded facilities and children sleeping on the ground.
What they're hearing is that you can now come into the United States, which you can as a kid, and so they're going to keep coming. And the problem here is that the Biden administration on day one made about a half dozen changes, and since then have made several more that encourage more people to come to the border, and they didn't put anything in place to deal with it, either another policy to discourage people from coming, which the president says he wants to do, or to put the preparations in place, including the shelters and the holding facilities that have been so criticized. And I saw some of them the other day. Kids are overcrowded. They're in situations you would never want your kid to be in.
There are also sponsors for the children, typically a family member in the U.S., who has to be located so that their identity and relationship to the child is verified. Meanwhile, the uptick of the unaccompanied children presenting themselves at the border remains a political matter. But how do the children feel?
The keeping children in custody is terrible for the children. It's been shown time and time again. Infamously, during the Trump administration, particularly during the 2018 zero tolerance policy that the Trump administration implemented, the world could see like what was happening with children the sort of things that happened in detention, even the abuses by the U.S. Border Patrol. But those sorts of things have been happening for a long time. There's a report by the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, from that looked at short-term Border Patrol detention effects on kids from 2009 to 2014. So mind you, that's the President Barack Obama years.
The highly politicized influx of children is contributing to the power play underway in the United States. High-ranking Republicans rush to blame particularly the Biden administration for the crisis. The administration's response has basically been, "We're doing all we can."
In the first 2.5 months of this year, they've made about 110,000 apprehensions. Including in those apprehensions are 800 criminal aliens who have previously been arrested and exported from the United States, 78 sex offenders, and 62 gang members.
At the same time, the administration is trying to send a message to the future refugees, asking them not to come to the U.S. The GOP, meanwhile, considers the Biden administration a big welcome sign to all the migrants seeking to enter through the Mexico border. Political steam has been building for 2 months since President Biden tackled some of Trump's harsh border policies. But the history of U.S. aggression towards Central America is older than that.
The Reagan administration and Bush father administration, they almost neutralized all the opposition in Central America. They occupied El Salvador, they occupied Honduras, they almost occupied Guatemala, and they attacked Nicaragua. So the social crisis in Central America is a fruit of U.S. policies during the 80s. That's a fact. So Republicans must be proud about what's happening now, because they promoted this terror in the 80s.
The crisis at the border gave former President Trump an opportunity to promote his own immigration policies. Trump said he proudly gave secure borders to Biden despite the current situation. Trump suggested that he created a smooth-running system on autopilot, which Biden has now broken.
This is a respite shelter in McAllen, Texas, near the U.S.-Mexican border. All of the people here, families and young children, arrived recently in the United States, many of them crossing the Rio Grande River with their families. They were apprehended by Border Patrol and sent to a detention center nearby. And then they come here for processing. This group here arrived in the morning. They'll get all their papers processed. They've all had COVID tests, and if they're negative, they're allowed to come to this shelter. For a few nights, maybe 1 or 2 days, this group over here has stayed here. They will move on to family members or sponsor families in the United States. But clearly, the numbers are surging here.
Trump's anti-immigration policy was a centerpiece of his 2016 election campaign and is now a major issue as he seeks re-election. As the U.S. president, he promised to build a wall on the U.S. border with Mexico to physically stop the inflow of migrants, but failed to fulfill that pledge. So what can Biden do, and will it make a difference?
Biden claims that he's going to reunite families who are separated under the Trump administration. He's going to review, if not reverse, what is known as the Remain in Mexico program, which has people who come to the U.S. border looking for asylum. It makes them wait on the other side of the border in Mexico, and there's been all kinds of problems with that. So on that level, Biden's policies almost seem revolutionary, in a sense, to Trump. On another level, and this is the level that I do want to speak to, they're very much the same. If you look at the U.S. border, it's been under a certain strategy now for 25 years.
During a similar record influx of unaccompanied minors in 2014, the Obama administration dispatched FEMA for help, something the Biden administration is resorting to as well. But violation of the non-Americans' rights is nothing new.
Children are only supposed to be in Border Patrol custody long enough for them to be processed, put into the system, booked in, if you will, and then moved on to HHS shelter. So that workforce right now, unfortunately, are stressed out, overwhelmed, and they're it's backed up. They have to get these facilities right. They have to move these children into HHS custody in 72 hours, and they're not able to do that because we are encouraging, as a country right now, we're encouraging people to send or bring a child to the border because you're getting a free pass, essentially, right? That's what happened in 2014.
Biden's failure to handle the situation is being heard loud and clear by human smugglers and those in search of supposedly better life in Central America. Crisis at the U.S. southern border is the tip of the iceberg, as many kids are already being detained by the Mexican government, never getting the chance to arrive at the U.S. border. There are also the human smugglers. What is your take on the human trafficking business reportedly booming these days across the U.S.-Mexico border?
Human trafficking and drug dealing in Central America and Mexico, it's a huge business, huge business. It wouldn't be operating without the commit and the corruption of Mexican authorities, but also it wouldn't be occurring without the complacency and the control, the coordination of U.S. agencies. It's just like DEA. You can't even imagine to worldwide drug dealing without DEA administrating it, controlling the cartels, opposing one cartel against the other, and eventually making profit of it.
Every child's story at the border is a unique one, but with a big portion of similarities. The kids are victims of the adults' behavior and decision-making. Deprived of compassion and the presence of their families, they enter a new environment with a new language and new faces.
One of the challenges we knew early on, what are the numbers, what's the intel look like? I think that's part of the reason why FEMA was asked to step in, is to help speed this process up, allow the agencies to get caught up with the children, and then build a system that would then be able to surge and move faster through the system.
The children with pressing needs must not be considered intruders. Living under the U.S. Border Patrol custody must be intolerable, especially for the really small children. Contending with the widening emergency that Biden team views as a stressful challenge rather than a crisis has been challenging for the young administration. Is it a crisis or not, and regardless of the terminology, are Republicans taking advantage of this?
They're taking on the new administration for sure. It seems like the Republicans are just looking for any sort of weakness on, and in a way, manufacturing a crisis. Like, by using the word crisis, they're saying that there's open borders with the Biden administration, which is patently not true. And so, yes, it seems like this is a key point for the Republicans. That was as we know, that was a huge central foundational point of the Donald Trump administration during his campaigns.
Overcrowding and harsh conditions in federal facilities have to be addressed. The administration is accused of hiding the reality of the situation by not allowing media to show specific places. Can the power-hungry steer clear of the politics and just act in favor of children?
They're 15, 16, 17 years old, all from Guatemala. They say they took 2, 3, 4 weeks to get to the United States. We asked them if they had any idea about the changes in the Biden administration in terms of policy for unaccompanied minors coming to the U.S. They said they had no idea. They said that they were coming to the United States because they wanted a better life for themselves, and it was too dangerous in Guatemala.
The president is scrambling to manage the growing humanitarian and political challenge, which could end up undermining his legislative agenda. The surge in border crosses is reportedly troubling the administration as the country's facilities keep working beyond capacity. Is it a crisis or not? Some are still discussing that. And can the Biden administration handle it? Mr. Miller, your take. What should be done to address the roots of the problem?
From the United States perspective, when you look at Central America, you have to look at U.S. policy in Central America. You have to look at at U.S. militarization in Central America. You have to look at even historic the U.S. supporting of dictatorships in Central America. You have to look at U.S. economic policy in Central America. You have to look at U.S. extractive industries in Central America and see how that influences how people are also being displaced. And when you like start getting to the root reasons, and when you see like a farmer who's marginalized or is poor can't make it, and then a drought hits that's climate induced, and those sorts of things, or a person's working in a U.S. factory that making under a livable wage, all those things are huge to the displacement. And when you deal with the displacement, you start dealing with all the branches of what people migrate under or are trafficked under. And it seems to me those are the sorts of issues that need to be addressed.
During his 2020 campaign days, the Democratic nominee had vowed to fix the country's broken immigration policy, something that is yet to materialize. Meanwhile, the situation appears to be getting out of control as the administration faces caravans of immigrants deemed illegal.
We're in the middle of a crisis on our southern border. The unprecedented surge of illegal migrants from Central America is harming both Mexico and the United States, and I believe the steps we will take, starting right now, will improve the safety in both of our countries. Going to be very, very good for Mexico. A nation without borders is not a nation. Beginning today, the United States of America gets back control of its borders, gets back its borders.
The Trump administration cracked down on immigration more than any other administrations in recent history. But the Biden team is also refusing to acknowledge the depth of the crisis and secretly pursues the same agenda. That has put forth a record in detentions and expulsions, as well as a boom in human trafficking into the country. How the situation will pan out remains to be seen. Thank you for staying with us. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi. I'm looking forward to seeing you again next week on We the People.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Limelight.
A key member of the legal team that sought to steal the 2020 election for Donald Trump is defending herself against a billion-dollar defamation lawsuit by arguing that no reasonable person could have mistaken her wild claims about election fraud last November as statements of fact. In a motion to dismiss a complaint by the large U.S.-based voting machine company Dominion, lawyers for Sidney Powell argued that elaborate conspiracies she laid out on television and radio last November while simultaneously suing to overturn election results in four states constituted legally protected First Amendment speech. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Tom McCarthy. The piece is titled, "Pro-Trump Lawyer Says No Reasonable Person Would Believe Her Election Lies." Stay with us for more of Tom McCarthy's article. Key member of the legal team that sought to steal the 2020 election for Donald Trump is defending herself against a billion-dollar defamation lawsuit by arguing that no reasonable person could have mistaken her wild claims about election fraud last November as statements of fact. In a motion to dismiss a complaint by the large U.S.-based voting machine company Dominion, lawyers for Sidney Powell argued that elaborate conspiracy theories she laid out on television and radio last November while simultaneously suing to overturn presidential election results in four states constituted legally protected First Amendment speech. No reasonable person would conclude that the statements were truly statements of fact, argued lawyers for Sidney Powell, a former federal prosecutor for Texas, who caught Donald Trump's attention through her involvement in the defense of his former National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn. Sidney Powell falsely stated on television and in legal briefs that Dominion machines ran on technology that could switch votes away from Donald Trump, technology she said had been invented in Venezuela to help steal elections for the late Venezuelan leader Hugo Chavez. Those lies were built on empty claims that apparently originated in anonymous comments on a pro-Trump blog, only to be amplified on a global scale by Donald Trump himself in a 12th of November tweet in which he wrote in part, "Report, Dominion deleted 2.7 million Trump votes nationwide." Citing lost business and reputational damage, the voting machine firm Dominion filed a $1.3 billion defamation lawsuit against Sidney Powell and her colleague on Donald Trump's legal team, Rudy Giuliani. A Dominion employee separately sued the Trump campaign after receiving death threats. Thousands of Donald Trump supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol building on Wednesday, 6th of January, in an effort to stop the certification of an election they considered invalid, killing a police officer in violent clashes in which four other individuals died. But lawyers for Sidney Powell argued her false statements about election fraud in the months preceding the Capitol insurrection were unmistakably not presented as true facts. It was clear to reasonable persons that Powell's claims were her opinions and legal theories on a matter of utmost public concern, her legal motion says. Those members of the public who were interested in the controversy were free to and did review that evidence and reach their own conclusions, or awaited resolution of the matter by the courts of law before making up their minds. The filing brought expressions of disbelief from Donald Trump critics. "This is her defense, wow," tweeted the Republican representative Adam Kinzinger. "Bad argument," tweeted Donald Trump's former lawyer Michael Cohen. "Powell should have gone with an insanity defense," due to Trump derangement syndrome. Shorter Sidney Powell, suckers, tweeted Charlie Sykes, an editor of the anti-Trump conservative publication, The Bulwark. As Donald Trump fought to reverse his election loss last November, the former president himself reportedly supported Sidney Powell's claims in private and trumpeted them in public, touting Powell 2 weeks after the election as a key part of the legal effort to defend our right to free and fair elections. Sidney Powell was publicly exiled from the Trump camp a week after that tweet, after she appeared at a news conference hosted by the Republican National Committee alongside Rudy Giuliani, whose hair dye memorably ran down his face, and Trump lawyer Jenna Ellis. The group was an elite strike force team that is working on behalf of the president and the campaign, Jenna Ellis announced. Then Sidney Powell faced the cameras and claimed to have identified massive influence of communist money through Venezuela, Cuba, and likely China in the interference with our elections here in the United States. Aides reportedly told Donald Trump that Sidney Powell was not helping, and Rudy Giuliani and Jenna Ellis issued a subsequent statement announcing, "Sidney Powell is practicing law on her own. She's not a member of the Trump legal team. She's also not a lawyer for the president in his personal capacity." But that did not prevent Powell from filing lawsuits the next week on Donald Trump's behalf in Georgia, Michigan, Arizona, and Wisconsin. In her defense against the Dominion defamation lawsuit, Sidney Powell argued that whatever reasonable persons thought of her wild claims, Dominion had failed to demonstrate that she herself thought them to be false as she spoke them, a key distinction in defamation cases. In fact, Powell's motion reads, she believed the allegations then, and she believes them now.
Ministry.
Six years since Saudi Arabia dragged along a coalition of Arab states to launch an unjustified war against Yemen. None of the Saudi military goals have been met. On the contrary, the Yemeni armed forces have gained more ground influence. However, the toll from the inhumane aerial and sea blockade that have taken on the people of Yemen is devastating. Yemenis need urgent humanitarian assistance to fend off hunger, to access vital health services, to maintain their dignity and resilience, and to rebuild their communities wrecked by Mohammed bin Salman's bombs. Recognized as the world's worst humanitarian crisis for the past 4 years, the country is now plunging towards the worst famine the world has seen in decades. Today in Yemen, 20 million people, that is two out of every three Yemenis, need some form of humanitarian and protection assistance. Of these, 12 million people are in acute need. More than half of the population are facing severe levels of food insecurity. Cases of serious malnutrition among children under 5 are the greatest ever recorded. Preventable disease is pervasive, and morbidity and mortality are increasing. Someone better grab Mohammed bin Salman and ask him already, is it worth it? What is so much more important than the life of a Yemeni kid starving to death because you simply impose a blockade on an entire nation? What about the consecutive U.S. administrations and European regimes who support Mohammed bin Salman's incremental genocide against Yemen? Do they ever consider individual Yemenis, especially the countries most susceptible, who are starving, suffering from disease, and bearing the brunt of almost 6 years of unjustified and inhumane war and blockade? Every one of them already knows that the only way to end the crisis in Yemen is through a lasting and inclusive peace. That can only be achieved if and when Saudi Arabia stops dropping bombs, lifts the blockade, and climbs down from its iron throne to sit at the negotiations table with the Yemeni armed forces. Quite ludicrous, to be honest with you, that Mohammed bin Salman can sit and talk with Netanyahu, but has a hard time doing the same with a nation that he shares the same history and culture with in the Arabian Peninsula. Hands off Yemen already. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Saudi war in Yemen shows no real signs of abating as it enters its sixth year. Civilians from across the country continue to bear the brunt of unjustified Saudi military hostilities and unlawful aerial, land, and sea blockades that resulted in a Mohammed bin Salman-made humanitarian crisis, which spiraled to approximately 20 million people waking up hungry every day. Despite the atrocities, Saudi Arabia has been trying for a year now to exit the war, as the Yemeni armed forces' advancements led to the fall of major areas once held by the Saudi occupation and its proxies, especially in the northern part of the country. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Sana'a is Mr. Mohammed Shami, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Mohammed. Now, on the sixth year of the Saudi war on Yemen, despite all the atrocities induced by the Saudi aggression, Mohammed bin Salman has been trying for over a year now to exit the war in Yemen, but it has been unsuccessful. It seems that Yemen has become quite the quagmire for Mohammed bin Salman, but how can he actually exit a war which he has not won?
Mohammed bin Salman does not have an exit strategy because he did not have one when he first started this war on Yemen March 2015. Remember when they started this war, they said officially that it would take only 2 weeks, and then they extended it into 2 months. And today, this is coming Friday, we are completing six full years. On the 21st of April 2015, they had to change. They repackaged this aggression and said, announced officially that the decisive storm operation ended, and they announced the beginning of restoration of hope. While everything on the ground stayed the same, the only thing that deferred was that they stopped bringing up the spokes of the aggression.
As well as causing the deaths and the injuries of thousands of civilians, Mr. Mohammed, the Saudi war in Yemen has exacerbated a severe humanitarian crisis, resulting in years of aerial and land blockade with the sole purpose of starving the nation into submission. This is what they are trying to do, and they have been trying to do for the past 6 years. Yet the Saudi strategy of the severe blockade has not borne any fruit yet. How come is that possible? How did that happen? The people are starving, but yet no one is submissive to the Saudi will.
Well, first of all, and above all, we have the full faith in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, His support and guidance. The other thing is that they have not only exercised the bombing and blockade, but also lately, as you know, they have detained fuel ships. And what that means is when you don't have an infrastructure and they already bombed the whole infrastructure, that means a death sentence to civilians. 30 million of them. So the reason why Yemenis are not submitting to their aggression and to their blockade, brutal blockade, is that the more they tighten this blockade, the more people realize that Saudi is their enemy. So people rather go to the front line and start fighting back rather than die starving on their bed.
Mr. Mohammed, since March 2015, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have led a so-called coalition of states against the nation of Yemen, and they were fighting severely against the Yemeni armed forces and the Yemeni resistance. However, over the past year, or even more than that, we saw that the alliance have fractured. We even saw some sort of a mini war happening between the proxies of Saudi Arabia and the proxies of the United Arab Emirates in the southern part of the country. Why did these proxies start to fight, and for what interest?
Let's look at first at who these proxies are. These proxies are made of different groups. Some of them are parties that they used to be official parties, like Islah or the Brotherhood, the People General Congress, who was in power for 33 years at least part of it, who decided to join the aggression. There is also the Southern Movement, the Southern Transitional Council, and then there is the Shabwani elite forces that they created of new. There is also Al-Qaeda in there. So all those groups, they are kind of heterogeneous. They don't have anything in common. The only reason why they are standing now together is because they decided to join the aggression against their own country and their own people. They are driven by either personal motives or monetary motives. And this is very sad because they play on the margin of things. While the aggressors, the country of aggression, represented by the USA and Israel, are taking over strategic places in Yemen, such as Socotra Island, and lately UAE moved their base from Asab in Eritrea to Miyun, right in the front, the gateway of the Red Sea, the Bab al-Mandeb.
Well, Mr. Mohammed, according to the Yemeni data project, the Saudi coalition has conducted more than 25,000 airstrikes on Yemen since the beginning of the war. That's an average of 12 per day. The coalition has bombed hospitals, school buses, markets, mosques, farms, bridges, factories, where everywhere where civilians, even prisons. Prisons were bombed by Mohammed bin Salman as well. How come all these atrocities are met with international deaf ear, yet the retaliatory attacks of the Yemeni armed forces, but especially against the oil facilities, get farther more attention from the media and the international community, if you will, as well?
Well, Yemen, the spokesman of the Yemen armed forces yesterday stated a much larger number than that for airstrikes. He said that the total airstrikes in 6 years had crossed 266,000 airstrikes. But anyway, there are a lot of airstrikes that, whether it's 25,000 or 250,000 plus airstrikes, these are atrocities coupled with blockade. Added to that, the detention of oil ships, and all this is faced with almost no comments from the UN and international community. It's a big shame because only when Yemen retaliates that they condemn, and you hear all the noise of those people speaking about the retaliations only. The reason I think for this is because mainly U.S., the U.S. Is a part of this aggression on Yemen. So there is a huge media blackout. They don't want the word to get out. And when it does, they usually distort the facts and tell the public their own version of the story. So the fact is the U.S. has been targeting Yemen
not only ever since this aggression started, the military aggression started, but we have seen during the past two weeks.
I'm sorry, but we are running low on time, but it was evident with what happened today with us, to be honest with you. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like you to know that it was very hard to actually get Mr. Mohammed with us because of the blockade, because of there is no internet, because there's a lot of applications that do not work in Yemen, because that's part of the war. It's war on information and war on mass media. They are not allowing us to get the voices of the Yemenis, the real Yemenis, like Mohammed Shami there from Sana'a with us, who is commemorating the sad 6 year of the Saudi war aggression, and not only war, a total aggression, war crimes against people of Yemen, incremental genocide against people of Yemen, which includes also a huge censorship on media. I want to thank you very, very much, Mr. Mohammed Shami, political commentator, for joining us from Sana'a to talk about the atrocities committed by Mohammed bin Salman, by his coalition, and by the Western regime also funding, aiding, and abetting Mohammed bin Salman. Thank you very much for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will continue talking about the ground victories of the Yemeni armed forces.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
In retaliation for the stepped-up Saudi-led military campaign and blockade against the Yemeni nation, the Yemeni armed forces carried out on Friday a new attack with six bomber drones targeting Aramco in the Saudi capital, Riyadh. The news comes as Yemeni armed forces have been making major gains in their decisive push to liberate the city of Ma'rib from the grip of Saudi occupation troops and their proxies. Ma'rib prepares for liberation in this following report. Overcoming a rugged and Sahara-like desert climate and under the constant fire of Saudi warplanes, the Yemeni armed forces advanced in Ma'rib governorate, liberating the Nakhla Valley near the western gate of the city of Ma'rib. Battles over Yemen's oil-rich Ma'rib province, which lies only 100 kilometers east of the capital Sana'a, have raged on since 2015 when the Saudi war began on the country. The clashes with Saudi occupation soldiers and their Salafist militant proxies against Sana'a's Yemeni armed forces, as well as partisans from local tribes. Those clashes have become fiercer as the war and Saudi-imposed blockade approach 6 years' duration on March 26, and amid a new push by Sana'a to liberate the last strongholds of the Saudi occupation from Mohammed bin Salman's control. For the past few months, Yemeni forces have fought a grueling ground campaign to recapture strategic points on Ma'rib battlefields, including villages and military positions surrounding Ma'rib city. Across the western and northwestern oil-rich fronts, fierce clashes have erupted as more local tribes join battles to reclaim ancient landmarks from Saudi occupation forces. 6 years have passed since Saudi Arabia attempted to impose a six-region federation of Yemen, a move that was refused by major Yemeni political parties, which saw it as a project to break up the country. Today, not only did Saudi Arabia miss all their military goals, they are also suffering heavy blows inside their own capital, Riyadh. The increase in the retaliatory attacks of the Yemen's armed forces on Aramco refineries in the Saudi capital since the beginning of 2021 are proof of the utter Saudi failure. Last week, using six bomb drones, the Yemeni armed forces stepped up their offensive on the kingdom's energy and military installations, both in Riyadh and King Khalid's military base in Khamis Mushayk. The spokesman of the Yemeni armed forces, General Yahya Sariya, stressed that the latest 6th of Sha'ban operation came in response to the Saudi brutal aggression and unjust blockade. General Sariya also reiterated his call on all citizens and companies to stay completely away from military positions as they have become legitimate targets of Yemeni armed forces and may be struck at any moment. Now to discuss this issue with us all the way from Sydney is Jay Therapel, member of the Yemeni Solidarity Council. Thanks a million for being with us at such an early hour of the day, Jay, to discuss mainly beginning with Operation 6 of Sha'ban, where six Yemeni bomber drones targeted Aramco inside the Saudi capital Riyadh, hitting its targets with high accuracy. That's according to the spokesperson of the Yemeni Armed Forces, General Yahya al-Sari'. Now, look, something also happened after that where Saudi Arabia bombed Sana'a, but then within hours, the Yemeni Armed Forces retaliated against Riyadh International Airport. Look, I'm trying to hide my smile, but I don't want to. But could you just help me explain to the audience, why am I smiling like that, Jay?
Well, I guess the reason it makes both of us smile is because we respect those who stand up to bullies. We smile because we know that Saudi Arabia will not stop bombing and starving Yemen until they start paying a price for their aggression. And it's not just Aramco that was targeted. I mean, the King Khalid, the military base in Asir province, which is an occupied province of Yemen, actually, Saudi-occupied, that base was also targeted by Yemeni drones. The reason this makes me smile is because it's so obvious now that the Saudis are covering up the damage being inflicted upon their military and oil infrastructure by the Yemeni resistance. And it shows that they're deeply embarrassed, because if the Saudis do start loudly publicizing to the world that they've been, let's say, victimized by Houthi drones, and if this causes people to look into what's actually happening in Yemen, then public opinion will turn against Saudi Arabia and in favor of the Yemeni national resistance. I mean, these strikes also demonstrate that there's only one state in Yemen, and that the National Salvation Government based in the capital Sana'a is the legitimate government. And that's because these are not the military capabilities of the Houthis. They are the capabilities of the Yemeni armed forces. So when you're faced with an enemy that's willing to kill millions of people by using starvation as a weapon, the only way you can make it stop is by violent retaliation of the kind that raises the cost of the occupation. The Yemeni resistance is not targeting civilians inside Saudi Arabia. They're only hitting what's necessary to force the Saudis to pay a price for the genocidal war they're waging against the people of Yemen.
Well, Yemen's Ansarullah declared that U.S. is trying to come up with some sort of a ceasefire plan, but that their plan, after six long years of Saudi aggression, does not go far enough, which actually prompted them to ramp up the pressure against the Saudi regime. They are causing so much pain for the regime, zero pain for the public. This is what we should be talking about. But at the same time, Mohammed bin Salman has delayed the inevitable. He delayed so much, more than 3 years now, delaying the exit from the war and the sitting at the negotiations table. I mean, his economy is on the line here. What is he waiting for?
Well, I mean, you know, we should really be using this opportunity, I think, to talk about the war on Yemen, to also highlight just how much this war is actually costing Saudi Arabia. I mean, you mentioned the economy, and it's for good reason, because it's been estimated that the Saudis spend about $200 million per day to wage war on Yemen,
wow,
which is about $73 billion per year, which if you carry it over for about 5 to 6 years is over $400 billion. I mean, the Biden administration has indicated that it wants to at least end U.S. support for offensive operations against Yemen. And this would still represent a scaling back of support to Saudi Arabia if it were to happen. Now, here I believe that the U.S. ruling class is truly divided when it comes to Yemen. And it's for serious reasons. On the one hand, they don't want the Yemeni resistance to win. But on the other hand, every dollar that the Saudis spend on war is one less dollar that could have been spent by the Saudis to buy U.S. Treasury bonds in order to finance the debts and the deficits that the United States has become accustomed to.
Sure.
The United States is the largest debtor in the world in absolute terms. And so the U.S. needs countries like Saudi Arabia to recycle their petrodollars into the U.S. banking system, because without these injections of cash from client regimes like Saudi Arabia, the U.S. might not be able to keep its inflation under control. The fact is that the Saudis have reduced their holdings of U.S. Treasury bills over the course of 2020. Back in January, this prompted the Arab News, which is a Saudi media outlet, to reassure the United States that the decline in Saudi holdings in U.S. government bonds was consistent with the kingdom's declining foreign exchange reserves mm-hmm. and did not reflect any policy of distancing between the two countries in financial markets. In other words,
it's like, sorry, we're not paying enough money.
Yeah, the Saudis are saying, look, it's not because we don't like you, America. It's because we're running out of money. That's what the Saudis are saying.
What's really interesting, though, Jay, is the Yemeni armed forces are able to move this armed confrontation from Sirwah, from Al-Mshaja and the Haylan fronts, which are around the city of Ma'rib, to the actual administrative area of the city itself in Ma'rib. And we're talking about the biggest base for U.S. occupation, for Saudi occupation, and its proxies, that the Freudian slip is actually true. But this enables the Yemeni forces to move the front line from Ma'rib as well into the actual city. But the question there is here, will they be pushed to use clashes inside of the city, or will that actually increase, maybe make it a fast pace for